This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we're going to listen back to a conversation we had about the nonprofit Taste of Immokalee. It's a student-run initiative that teaches high school kids about business, the food industry, and marketing, among other things. But first, we're talking about sustainability in the food industry, which will be part of the Naples Next Ideas Festival. That's an event that will begin this Sunday, talking about everything from medical breakthroughs to public policy, but also food, specifically sustainability. As part of the James Beard Foundation panel. And we're going to be talking today with the Chief Operating Officer of the James Beard Foundation, Chris Moon. We're also talking with three local chefs who are going to be part of that panel. Chef Asif Syed from 21 Spices, Jason Goddard, from Sea Salt, Barbatella and Dorona, and also Vincenzo Betulia from Osteria Tullio and the French. It's going to be a really fun conversation. So if you have any thoughts that you'd like to add about sustainability in the food industry, give us a call. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. So first, Chris Moon, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the James Beard Foundation. For people who aren't familiar, tell me a little bit about it.
Sure. Well, hello, and thank you for having me. The James Beard Foundation is a national culinary nonprofit organization. We are headquartered in New York City, but do work all across the country. And our mission is really to celebrate, nurture, and honor chefs and other leaders making America's food culture more delicious, diverse, and sustainable for everybody. And we do that through our annual awards program, which is what we're probably best known for. We maintain the historic James Beard House in New York City as a performance space for chefs, which we've done for more than 30 years. And we have a whole suite of impact programs that really focus on improving the food system in America. And that is both through sustainability and environmental sustainability topics, but also pushing for broader diversity and inclusion within the culinary community, both through gender and other underrepresented groups.
It's covering quite a bit of ground there, but it's kind of like the Academy for the movies James Beard is to dining, but there's a lot more to it than that, it sounds like.
There is. We're often, the Beard Awards in particular, are often referred to as the Oscars of the food industry, so I think there is definitely some similarity there, but the lesser-known side of the James Beard Foundation is really the work that we've been doing in the last decade to support women in the industry, to give scholarships for the next generation to help them gain access to the kind of education they need to have a successful career in the culinary arts, and really specifically the work we've been doing to help chefs become advocates for a better food system in America and to really use their voice, leverage their power to speak up on the issues that they care about. Whether that be food waste reduction or sustainable seafood or childhood nutrition. But we are really trying to help them embrace that power, that platform, and that voice to create change in the world.
So you first joined the foundation in 2007 as the director of house operations and house events. Tell me a little bit more about this house. What is this?
So the James Beard House in New York City is really where it all began for the James Beard Foundation. It was James Beard's home the last about 12 years of his life. It's a 1843 brownstone in the West Village, New York City. And when he lived there, he lived in the space. He taught cooking classes there, wrote cookbooks, entertained. And when James Beard passed away, it was actually Julia Child and a number of his friends that came together and said, we need to purchase the house to really save this legacy of what James Beard had started. And so they did. And the James Beard Foundation was started in the mid-80s to really support the culinary arts in America. But the house has always been, I'd say, really the heart of what we do as an organization. There's incredible history in the walls of that townhouse. And for 30 years now, we have welcomed in chefs from all around the United States and all over the world who come in really to prepare a menu for one night only in the kitchen that used to be James Beard's. And we open up those events to our membership, but also to the general public. And it's a really amazing way to see the breadth of what's happening in the culinary industry around the country, but also globally, and just have a taste of the way the food scene is developing. So it's a really special place. It's a quirky, wonderful, unique experience in the West Village of New York City, where we like to say there's always something delicious happening.
Mm-hmm. It's really kind of interesting. I think it's kind of like a foodie destination, I would imagine. So you continued to work with the foundation and launched the Chef's Boot Camp for Policy and Change. I'm wondering, what made you think that that was something important to do?
You know, it was in early 2012, and we had a couple of trustees on our board who have worked in the policy space in the past, one of which was James Beard Award-winning chef Michelle Nichon, who was the founder of Wholesome Ways, a really wonderful nonprofit, but who had come from a career in you know, as a James Beard Award-winning chef. And another gentleman named Eric Kessler, who works in philanthropy and has been working in policy for many decades. And we started a conversation just looking at the way the culinary community had evolved in the United States, but in particular the way the role of chefs in modern-day society and pop culture had really come to the forefront. And in 2012, that was really just starting to happen. Chefs were starting to have this really incredible platform with huge audiences and an opportunity to speak up about things that they felt passionately about, not just talking about the food that they made, the delicious food that they made, but their views, their values, the story behind the food. And Eric, our trustee Eric Kessler, had been involved in helping to create something similar for musicians many years ago to help musicians understand how to leverage their platform and their voice to drive social change in the world. And so we came together and said, you know, I think there's a moment now in food, and chefs have reached a kind of place in society where people are listening to them, people are following them, they're tastemakers, trendsetters, business owners, economic drivers. We have an opportunity to help them understand how to leverage that position, how to understand the power of their voice, to get involved beyond the four walls of their restaurant. And so we piloted this program called the Chef Boot Camp for Policy and Change in July of 2012. We took 15 chefs from all over the country to Tennessee and put them on a farm and did 3 days' worth of policy training and advocacy training, role play, to really help them understand the power and the potential of their voice. And what we found was that there was a tremendous receptivity to that from the 15 chefs who came. And one of the things that we love about the chef community the most is that the chef community is actionable. The restaurant always has to open tonight. Service has to go on no matter what happens. And so it's an incredible community that jumps into action in a way that not every other community does.
Yeah, they probably wouldn't have a whole lot of patience for sitting around and coming up with ideas and then presenting them. They're like, this is a thing. Let's do it, and we'll do it now.
You know, and it's an interesting thing. It's, you know, oh, the fish delivery didn't arrive, but the restaurant still has to open tonight. So, you know, what are we going to do instead? So it's a group that is really good at thinking on their feet and putting a plan into action. And so we officially launched that program in the spring of 2013. And to date, we've now held 17 Chef Boot Camp for Policy and Change programs and have almost 300 chefs across the country who have been through that training program and are now really actively engaged in supporting a better food system.
Okay, so I want to jump forward a little bit to late last year, the Agriculture Improvement Act of 2018, which is also known as the Farm Bill, that was passed. Mm-hmm. And I read that you were instrumental in educating people in the food industry, and mainly chefs, about how these policy decisions would kind of impact the food world. How did that education campaign go in connecting creative chefs with something as abstract and kind of complicated as the Farm Bill?
The Farm Bill is a massive piece of legislation, as those who know it are aware, and it's complex and includes a lot of different elements. And so through our Chef Boot Camp program in the last couple of years, we have been using the Farm Bill as an example. So doing education through that program on what's in the Farm Bill, what it governs essentially, and really starting to talk to the chef community and the chefs that were going through that program about how to leverage their voice in support of what they wanted to see in the Farm Bill. And I think it's really important to stress that from the James Beard Foundation standpoint, we haven't really been advocating a specific position and really pushing chefs to take a specific position. We've really been advocating for chefs to have a position, to develop their own position, to understand what is in a piece of legislation, and then to figure out how to leverage their voice in support of that. The chef community is vast, and there are competing opinions and desires, and so we have been really careful not to dictate what that perspective should be, but to really be the catalyst for them using their voice.
So and synthesizing that
program.
I mean, like getting their voices and getting their ideas and then synthesizing that into something that they can make into some sort of a presentation or some kind of a I don't know, maybe a request.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because I think, you know, the Farm Bill is a bit of a mystery to a lot of people in this country, what it governs. You know, it's a Farm Bill. It's not called a food bill, but it actually governs our agriculture and a lot of what we eat. And so I think turning on that light bulb on for the chefs that we work with and really, you know, peeling back the curtain on what's included in that was a great education opportunity, and in turn, really got them excited to participate, to step up, to meet with their elected officials, to do education in their communities, to try to help the broader community in the United States to understand what this massive piece of legislation really controls and sets and what it means for what we eat every day.
Well, and last time I looked at a farm bill, it was a while back, but I was shocked at how much of it is commodities and how little is what we actually eat, like fresh produce. I mean, there were reams on corn and soybeans, but then like maybe two lines about tomatoes. Does it still look like that? Or did you see any change or anything come of chefs' involvement in having their voices heard?
I'm going to start by saying I am not a Farm Bill expert, so I'm going to put that out there.
Nobody is. It's impossible. That thing is huge.
It is a very hard thing to be a Farm Bill expert. Those commodity crops are certainly still in there. You know, the kind of broader fruits and vegetables that we talk about on a daily basis and that, you know, our community is often purchasing are really specialty crops, as they're referred to in the Farm Bill. But, you know, from my understanding, there were some great wins in the last Farm Bill, both for specialty crops and also support to SNAP. And so largely it, you know, it's there are always people on both sides of these massive pieces of legislation, but many in our chef community were pleased with the outcome after they had really gotten involved in kind of speaking up and supporting what they would like to see in the Farm Bill.
So when we talk about sustainability in the food system, what does that encompass? Is that talking about sustainability of the environment, quality, fair labor practices in the field, in the kitchen? What does that encompass?
You know, I think increasingly it's all of those things. It's sustainability for the planet, so the environmental piece. It's sustainability and taking into consideration the people who produce and transport and get our food to our table. And I think one of the things that we also talk about with the chef community often is that there's also nothing sustainable about not being able to keep your restaurant doors open. So there is a business sustainability component within that. So you can endeavor to buy, you know, all local, all organic, you know, traceable all the way back to the field and the farmer, every product you want. But if it bankrupts your business, there's also nothing sustainable about that. So everybody has to make these decisions on a daily basis to walk the values that they believe in, while also, of course, continuing to keep their business open and keep their employees employed and be that economic driver that they are in their communities, which is, you know, that's a difficult task to try to juggle all of those components and make those daily decisions about where you're going to support and where you're going to source, who you're going to support with your dollar, and what that means to your business.
Yeah. If you're just joining the show, I wanted to remind listeners that we are talking about sustainable food systems. We're talking with Chris Moon, the Chief Operating Officer of the James Beard Foundation. It's going to be part of the Naples Next Ideas Festival next week. We're also talking with Chef Asif Syed from 21 Spices in Naples. Let me get that number right. 21. 28 is a little too many. No, I was kidding. We're also talking with Jason Goddard from Sea Salt, Barbatella, and Dorona. And we're also talking with Vincenzo Batulia from Austria Tulia and the French in Naples. And I'm wondering, listeners, does sustainability matter to you when you go out to eat? Give us a call and tell us why at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So one of the things that strikes me about movements like sustainability, farm to fork, eating local, is the culture that's behind it. And in some cultures, it's just as like a basic understanding of the way things just are. So I wanted to talk with the three Naples chefs that we have here today about how their views on food were formed. And I want to start with you, Jason. You're from Iowa, neighbor. I'm from Missouri, so good to see you again. How did Iowa shape your perception of food systems when you were growing up?
Well, when I was growing up in Iowa, we lived on a small bit of land, about 28 acres, where we We raised everything from corn to any vegetables, anything we wanted to eat, chickens. We had a dairy farmer right down the road, so we kind of traded and bartered and kind of lived the old-fashioned life. I washed the clothes with the ricket board. We had the compost pile, and we didn't have – we had, like, the burn pile. So for me, it was a big understanding on what – the way it was for thousands and thousands of years, how you had to survive. After that, I ended up moving into the city and kind of got a different viewpoint of the impact of food. If you didn't raise it or you didn't care for it, you wouldn't be able to have anything to eat. Where in the city, you could just purchase it from a market.
Yeah.
So we did that, and we sold to the farmers markets. It was a unique time when I was growing up in Iowa, too. That was when Monsanto was coming in and giving out seeds. And so it was a pretty big impact on the small farmer community.
So you were seeing also, as you were growing up, the impact of this industrialization, really. I mean, it had kind of been industrialized already to some extent, but it kind of really ramped up while you were young.
Yes, yes. I got to see it firsthand experience. It was enough to drive me to want to make sure that, you know, I supported people that had the same beliefs. We didn't call anything organic because we didn't put pesticides on it. We used heirloom seeds because it was a better product. It had better flavors.
Because you could use it the next year, too, after you got more seeds. It's not a hybrid, right?
Yeah.
It's really interesting that you were kind of like right there in the crossroads, though, because that part of the country is where the corporate stuff happens, you know, in Iowa. But then you also had this little pocket of old school.
Yeah, yeah. And that's one thing that I've seen over the years, how it's transitioned. It's still there. Big business. Agriculture is big business out there. There's no stopping that. But the more that you can do to we have a lot of stuff, co-ops up in Iowa, where you've got teams of 40, 50 different little small farmers selling under one bigger umbrella to get the bigger amenities like food distribution and getting their product out there and still raising good quality products.
Kind of having a band together.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of that. Chef Asif, I wanted to find out a little bit more about the food situation where you grew up. How were you impacted by the food ways when you were young?
So it's very, very amazing that, you know, I'm from India. I'm southern part of India. I was born in a city called Hyderabad. And when we were growing up, if you see India is a 70% agricultural country. So it was a totally different, era and different time than now. And we used to have a big kitchen garden because we had a big land and pretty much we used to grow annual and perennial, crop. And my dad taught us all those things. We used to make our own manure. We used to take the cow dung, make the manure, compost, everything we used to do those days. And also we used to find only particular seasonal fruits, seasonal vegetables. Now we find year-round.
Yeah.
You know, that's a big problem. And there was a big regulation those days that, you know, animals were, you know, very humanely, slaughtered or, you know, raised. And it was very tough to transport from different cities. And still it is. Some of the part of India is like that. And that was really good, actually, because you don't go overboard and, you know, take advantage of the situation. So mango we only ate in the season because we need to understand that all these things, our body needs things on that particular time of the year. We don't have to, our body doesn't need mango in December. Our body needs mango.
Maybe my taste buds do, though. That's a problem. You have this expectation of availability.
Yes. So because you have to go with it. That is what we chefs, we know what is available at that time of the year and what we can utilize it. And we are educating people and people understand it better. And why not? I mean to say we can even have those mangoes pickled or something, but not to an extent, you know.
Yeah. I mean, do you find, though, that sometimes it's difficult as a restaurant owner that your customers will come in and have this expectation that you have this thing all the time?
Yes, they do. But slowly we are changing that perception of the customer by educating them.
So for you, sustainability has a lot to do with seasonality.
Yes. And also not only seasonality, but but also I want to know where the stuff is coming from, who is bringing to me, and what is the source. I really want to know, and because a lot of time now people are very smart, they're asking questions too. If I'm getting my dry spices from India, I want to really know where is it coming from. And so I want to get more details of it because, you know, we are all part of, you know, this campaign of sustainability.
Mm-hmm. And Vincenzo Battuglia, thank you for being patient on the phone. Tell me a little bit about the food traditions that shaped your young chef mind.
Well, thanks, Julie, for having me on, and hello to the other chefs. And Chris, you know, mine is very, very similar to my fellow chefs here. My parents immigrated from Sicily to the state of Wisconsin when I was 2 years old. And so, you know, living in America, in Wisconsin, but really kind of seeing and living an old world mentality. I too had, you know, farms in the backyard. You know, we definitely grew our own produce. My father and my uncles would rent plots of land, county land, to grow more vegetables. And what we did is, you know, we honestly just picked and canned. We did everything ourselves. So, you know, growing up in America and having my grandmother putting, you know, drying tomatoes that were picked in September and October, and putting them out on the driveway, and the people looking at us like, "And what are you doing?" And, you know, here we are making, we're canning tomatoes and we're making tomato paste that can get us through the winter, obviously. But we're picking them fresh. You know, we're not fertilizing and anything. We're just growing, we're seeding, and that's what we're doing. And, you know, that has kind of really kind of put my mentality as a restaurant owner and a chef, and I kind of just, you know, execute it the same way on a daily basis. So I operate my restaurants just like they do in France and in Italy, because it just comes natural to me. And so it's giving me the opportunity as a business owner and a chef to educate and enlighten people in Naples, because I don't think they really think about that. You know, here in America, it's easy to just go to a fast food restaurant or a big box or chain restaurant and get food, you know. But for me, it's more of an educational process, you know, and getting together with community leaders, knowing, you know, traceability, food sustainability, supporting local, and that's what we've been doing ever since we've opened Osteria, you know, getting that relationship with farmers. And really knowing, you know, how it's being grown and where it's being grown. And when it's done, when the season is over, it's over. And that's why we print menus in-house. We change, you know, we can have short seasonality on things like Florida peaches, for example. I've had people say that peaches don't grow in Florida. But I think a lot of people don't realize that our Florida peach season is pretty short. It's only a couple of weeks. So, you know, it's kind of neat to be able to educate and enlighten these people. That's what, you know, makes me proud to be a part of the Naples Next, and, you know, and to be with these chefs as we're growing the culinary scene here in Naples.
I'm not going to say it's the only thing that grows in summer, but I imagine that you've all three gotten inventive with okra. Because Florida okra in the summertime is pretty much it. That and peppers, right?
Yes.
So there's something that we all were talking through this conversation. We're hearing a lot of the old ways, like old country, like in Sicily and India and even the country in Iowa, you know. It's the same country, but it's kind of like an older kind of like institution. And these are not ways of like nobility upper echelon, right? These are kind of, you know, salt of the earth kind of folks and their regular traditions. However, and this is something I don't know if we can even tackle this, but there's a unique little class situation that happens in the United States when conversations about sustainability, heirloom produce, organic farming, and things like this kind of come up. People sometimes see that as a luxury. You know, sometimes people who haven't been raised, as the three chefs we're talking with, have been raised. And I'm reminded of a quip from Slow Food International's founder, Carlo Petrini. He went to the Ferry Building in San Francisco, And, you know, if you've ever been there, all manner of beautiful produce. But it's not cheap. He seemed a little bit dismayed. He's talking about people parading through veggie stalls with overpriced miniature eggplants nestled like little gems in their produce basket, you know, as if it was a status thing to do that. He was talking about kind of like an elitism that became attached to the farm-to-fork movement that swept through the U.S., like, you know, in the 2000s, mid-2000s. I'm wondering if that elitism is still there. Maybe, Chris, you can speak to this on a national level, and then we'll ask the local chefs if they're seeing any of that kind of attitude locally.
Sure, and I think it's a really great question. And I think that the good news is, at least from what we're seeing across the country, there's some great work being done around this specific topic. There are programs like the Wholesome Ways program that doubles the value of food stamps when used at farmers markets, the Double Box program, and there are programs like that in more than 30 states, I believe, around the country now, where if you're on SNAP, for example, and you choose to use your SNAP benefits at a farmers market to buy fresh fruits and vegetables, those SNAP benefits actually count for two times as much. And that is a really beautiful, interesting policy way to support access to better fruits and vegetables for people who may be in a lower income bracket or on supplemental nutrition assistance. And so I think we're seeing some really interesting movement there and some creative ways to address that. You know, this is where I come back to policy and why we have been talking to the chef community for many years now about policy, because what you referenced earlier about the Farm Bill and commodity crops, you know, this is part of why fast food is cheaper and specialty crops, fresh fruits and vegetables, are more expensive, because they are, you know, not subsidized. They are, there's no true cost of food that I think we're seeing as consumers. And so that is part of the problem. But I think there's some really innovative solutions that are being undertaken across the country, and I really think I would hold up Wholesome Wave as a really incredible organization that has been pioneering that at a national level.
It's interesting, Chris, that you point to policy when it comes to this, because it's kind of policy that created the situation where we have, you know, the meme, we've all seen it, of, you know, fries for 99 cents and a big thing of fruit for $5.99. Mm-hmm. And it's those subsidies that that are creating that type of an atmosphere where the pricing is unequal like that. But then you end up having other policy that attempts to level the playing field with things like SNAP. I wonder if there might ever be a future where we see a reversal in some of the large crop subsidies that make that type of processed, you know, corn syrup kind of thing. Do you foresee a time when that might ever go away because of policy?
It's an interesting question, and I don't know, to be honest. I think, you know, the policy battles are large, and the industrialized food system is massive. But I think policy is a very powerful tool to drive large-scale change, which is why it's become important to us at the foundation and why it's something that we're going to continue to help the chef community engage in, because it is admirable and absolutely great to build relationships with farmers and start at the local level and support the people who are, you know, growing food in a way that you believe in. But we can drive change a lot faster if we also address some of these things at a national or even a state policy level.
Yeah. So let's get back down to local chefs. Do you guys, how do you feel about this type of availability of a platform to try to enact change and get people more interested in sustainable food? I mean, I know you're creative people who just make really good dishes, and are you just convincing people with the taste? Everybody's pointing at each other. I'm just going to go cook something. So what do you think, Jason?
Yeah, I definitely think that you have to have the taste first and foremost. It's – now going back to your question about is luxury ingredients – is that only for certain people, like, you know, more expensive ingredients? We'll take the lobster for instance, you know. Lobster was one of the food that was just thrown away that nobody really ate, and then everybody started liking it. It was kind of that poor man's food. Mm-hmm. And then it became the forefront and became this luxurious ingredient because nobody had it. Nobody was eating it. And so
they availability,
said, they right? said, well, you know what? Wait a second. No, I want some of that. Everybody else is eating that. And then it became more popular and more trendy for the elitists to start eating. And I think that, you know, it goes back to taste, yes, because, you know, sure, a lot of people like it. But then it goes back to, I don't have that. I want it. You know, different things. And that's one thing that, you know, I do love about Italian cuisine is they take the small parts of different things, the throwaways, the honest ingredients, and showcase those and bring them to the forefront. And that's one thing that I believe in is, yes, taking and adding some luxury ingredients. Obviously, we have a different kind of clientele down here in Naples that they have certain tastes. They have certain wants. So you try to wrap it all together in one nice like basket for them. Kind of get a little bit of what you stand for, a little bit what they want, and, you know, serve it on in a way that, you know, you can stand behind.
Mm-hmm. Which is very important, you know, also if you're a business owner, and again, you know, when you're a chef, and even if you're the chef and just, you know, just the chef and not the owner, you know, you have to represent what the ownership's about. And, you know, you're as a chef, you're taking the ownership of the restaurant. So it's a very fine line that we have to walk, especially, you know, tastes are extremely personal. And so some people are looking for lobster. I don't, you know, and none of my restaurants, I don't have any lobster on my restaurant, in my restaurant. And I may run it as a special. But, you know, at times I have to understand who my demographic is. And, you know, knowing the seasonality of what they're expecting. They're coming down here to Florida. So I think a lot of people don't truly realize that our growing season is in the winter. And, you know, and theirs is in the summer. So they think that it's winter because they're coming from up north. And so it's kind of reversed. And so for us, you know, we're going to feature what's in season. That's why we support, you know, husband and wife farms. And, you know, these local growers like Circle C or Calusa or, you know, these little farms that are just growing for us. And it's pretty cool.
Chef Asif, I want to ask you, what kind of challenges have you faced at 21 Spices? Are all the 21 Spices from Florida?
There's only one 21 Spice. You know, Indian cuisine, I have a great advantage. Indian cuisine is a vegetarian-based cuisine. So you have so many options. And, you know, it's India is a huge country. So, you know, I can always have those different options depending on the situation. So if I don't I have, you know, like Vincenzo said, we do seasonal menus and I can always change. And, you know, the area where I come from, India, I don't have lobster. So if I don't have lobster, it's fine. I can always substitute with something else. So sometimes I do have problems, you know, if I'm doing a big, huge catering or a very high-profile wedding or something, then, you know, I have to get some product. But other than that, as far as the restaurant is concerned, I'm always flexible. And also 21 Spices is also very, very well known for vegan and, you know, vegetarian dishes.
Yeah, which has got to be just bountiful for you in the wintertime.
Big, bountiful, yeah. Anytime, depending on the season, I can get any kind of vegetables I want, which is locally, you know, I can always utilize it because we have all those things in India, especially the south part of India where I come from. It's very similar to the climate here.
Oh, yeah.
So I blend very well here. It works out very well for me.
I'm wondering about, though, the logistics and the dependability of a small local farm. Small local farms are great, but they don't have an entire fleet of Cisco trucks that are going to be driving by your restaurant every single day. So how much of a tightrope are you walking when you're trying to always feature local farmers and their products in your restaurant when you have to have it that day? Or you happen to have a super spike on a weird Tuesday when everybody in the world decided to go out and eat out of nowhere. And then Wednesday, you're looking at an empty shelf and you know you don't have a shipment for a week. Is that a tough one? Or are the logistics better than they used to be?
Well, definitely how we've handled that over with Sea Salt in the last 10 years was I'd have a group, like multiple different farms. I'd have 8 or 10 different farms that I'd have to. So when, you know, because they have it when it's ready.
Yeah.
And so, which is great. So you supplement in with some of those when they have it ready. And then you have to have some of the bigger box type of stuff, vendors that you still believe in and go through. But you almost have to have it and showcase it when it's ready and supplement in with that. We were with Warden Farms and Lady Moon and Rabbit Run over the years. Just it's one of those things that you can't rely on one farm to grow for you at the time. You have to have some supplement in, or else you have to be changing the menu every single night. You know, and yeah. When it's
and the logistical issue, I'm sure, and Jason could probably agree with me that they know how to grow a great product, but some of these farms they don't really think about, or they just haven't gotten to that point of how to get the product to you. You know,
and or, so for so me, did you have to did you have to like go out and run to farms every once in a while?
Yeah, when we opened up Osteria at the time, you know, we were buying from some of the same farms that Chef Jason was, you know, because we've been in the community, you know, down here a little bit longer, and it's crazy. I've had to get in my car, and I have a smaller car, and here I am piling, you know, vegetables, produce, and there's still like dirt, you know, in my back seat. And this is how we had to do it in order to educate. But, you know, nowadays, like Jason said, you know, you can supplement with other farms. Obviously, it's gaining more popularity. People are becoming a little bit more aware, and they're asking. And, you know, we're labeling the farms on our menus here within the Campania Hospitality Group. But, you know, what I've done to make my life a little bit easier, because it becomes challenging, is that I've actually hired a gentleman to go and pick it up for me.
Oh.
So he has a van and a truck. And I just say, okay, this is where you're going today. He picks up some of the other local restaurants in town. If he's going to like markets in Miami, he'll stop by some of the other restaurants and try to sell to them. But in the end, I've pretty much procured him just to go get product. So if he's saying, "Oh, I'm going to be in Miami," I says, "Okay, well, you can swing by, you know, Swank Farms and pick up some lettuce, or you can, you know, you can go to one of my other local farms. Like, well, Calusa has their own, so they've figured it out. They actually hired a driver, so now we're getting product from them. But there's many other farms that they don't know how to get the product to you."
God, I feel like it was only like, you know, 8 or 9 years ago when there were only a couple local farms, though. You know, there just weren't that many back then, but it really has blossomed. There are a lot more around to choose from and to be able to get to.
Yes, I totally agree with you. The situation is getting much better than before. It is a challenging, you know, sometimes it's very challenging that it's tough for them to bring. And as chef, it's not easy for us to leave and go somewhere. And, you know, once in a while we can do it, but we are extremely busy people. We have to be focused in what we are doing. But
I'm just excited I got you all on the phone and here in the studio.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen often.
Sure. So, but again, you know, it starts somewhere, but it's getting much better. But, you know, we definitely, you know, I start buying the local microgreens and all those things which come from locally. And, you know, things are looking better and getting better, actually. But, you know, like you said, there are now more options now.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that if you don't find some item in particular farm, you can always call the other person. That flexibility we have now.
And another thing that we don't have a whole lot of control over at all is seafood. And I'm wondering, I know that you all work with fresh local seafood. The sea salt kind of makes that their calling card, though. And I wanted to ask Jason, did you have a tough time this past year when it came to getting fresh local fish after red tide, blue-green algae, the hurricane hangover? Was it difficult this year?
It was difficult. You know, the main thing over the last, you know, 10 years, we've been working through that too, where we have some different purveyors that will help, and they have the small day boat people going for them. We have a couple day boat guys that personally goes for us and some of the other guys around town. And, you know, they were hurting a little bit during the red tide. Luckily, like I said, you have to have strength in numbers. So you have to have maybe 10, 15 of these day boat guys through three or four different companies going out and finding the stuff and going out maybe not necessarily down here but maybe north of Okeechobee or over on the other coast over in Fort Lauderdale, the swordfish, you know, a lot of things, not just the water, the red tide has affected and does affect seafood because, you know, the planet is primarily water. The moon affects the swordfish and the tuna fishing, and prices and demand go up and quality goes down. It's a tough thing, you know, where the last super moon blood wolf thing came through and all the swordfish was the quality was going down. So we had to take that off of the menu.
I could just see, you know, you're dealing with all this in the background, and then this one guy from Ohio comes down and he's mad because his swordfish isn't there.
That's the grouper. That's the grouper situation now.
That's grouper for sure.
But, you know, it definitely does get, you know, tricky. And, you know, we might end up ruining somebody's night because we don't have the grouper for them. But we just try to show them why and teach them why, kind of like what Chef Asif was talking about. You have to educate your clientele and the guests to say, hey, you know, this is why we have this. This is why we don't have this. I know that you're so set on grouper. Try this golden tile. It's way better. Better texture, better flavor.
Tilefish is good stuff.
Yes, it is.
It is true. That is true. People overlook that one all the time. Well, we are about to run out of time. I'm really sorry I could talk about food all hour. I want to thank all of you guys for taking the time out of your incredibly busy days to talk with me. Chef Asif Sayed from 21 Spices in Naples, Jason Goddard from Sea Salt Barbatella and Derona, and also Naples Chef Vincenzo Batulia from Austria Tulia, the French in Naples, and Chris Moon, COO of the James Beard Foundation. Thank you all for talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. Thank you for having us on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All three chefs will be part of the Naples Next Ideas Festival next week. The Chef's Roundtable is Monday, March 18th at 5 p.m. and is followed by the event's signature dinner at 6:30 p.m. You can find links to more information on our website at gulfcoastlive.org. When we return, Taste of Immokalee has a few new flavors, but it's more than just pulling out a new recipe. We'll listen back to a conversation we had with the people from Taste of Immokalee about their latest new products and all the work that goes into bringing new flavors to the market. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.